U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder promises a thorough and independent investigation into the deadly police shooting of Michael Brown. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In this edition of the Week in Review, we will talk with two guests from different perspectives about the latest developments in Ferguson, Missouri, and the lessons that we are learning about race relations and police violence. That's coming up. Plus, we will get our guests to weigh in on the killing of an American journalist by ISIS, a massive ad buy against Governor Walker, and other top national and state political stories. Plus, we want to know what you want to talk about. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. With us, Chris Lotto, a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And Eugene Kane, a columnist and blogger from Milwaukee. His writings appear on Sundays in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Well, let's talk about Ferguson first. The National Guard is leaving Ferguson, Missouri. Governor Jay Nixon ordered the Guard to begin pulling out of the St. Louis suburb after a third night of relatively peaceful protests following the fatal shooting of an unarmed black 18-year-old man by a white police officer. Well, Eugene, let's start with you. Why do you suppose things are finally quieting down in Ferguson?
Well, I think it's probably fatigue on the part of protesters and hopefully the general community and hopefully even the law enforcement people just got tired of having to deal with it and moderated their actions. I mean, there have been more level-headed people like the state highway captain, Ron Johnson, down there who had some impact on quelling things. And, of course, Eric Holder showing up, I've heard, did a lot to kind of give the people what they wanted, which was some sign that Washington, D.C. or society was hearing their complaints. So I think it kind of burnt out because it was at such a fever pitch. God, I can't imagine what would have happened if it had continued at that intensity. But I think the main reason it's calmed down, they're getting a sense that people have heard them and have seen what's happening. And I think probably even some people in Ferguson are more aware of the fact that the world is watching them, both protesters and police.
Yeah, it was really unreal watching that, Chris Lotto. What are your thoughts on what we've been witnessing in Ferguson?
Yeah, it is an unreal story, and it's good news that things seem to be returning back to a sort of baseline of normalcy, because I think that's what, you know, everybody wanted to see. Certainly that's what Washington wanted to see, was for the unrest to come to an end, you know, schools and shops to reopen, and for the National Guard to get out of there and for things to kind of return to normal. It's, you know, it's a weird situation. To Eugene's point about this, you know, idea that people wanted to know that they were being paid attention to. So to the degree that the Attorney General getting involved help the situation, because I think that's what we're all waiting for now. I think that we need to see a thorough investigation, because you know we weren't there. We're hearing so many differing accounts of what actually went down that we need to kind of get all the facts in before passing a further judgment. So you know, presumably the Attorney General's office will conduct a thorough investigation. We're starting to see some of the results of the autopsies, but we don't have the whole story yet. None of us do, and I think that hopefully with things calming down in Ferguson, that'll give an opportunity for us to see that thorough investigation and to get the full story on what really happened.
A grand jury has begun hearing evidence as it weighs the possible charges against the officer involved, Darren Wilson. Eugene Kane, do we really know enough now to arrest this police officer?
I think you certainly have enough to take them off the street, certainly suspend them or do something of that point. I don't know about actually charging him until we find out the initial encounter, what happened. What I hear, and the thing that disturbs me most, is that there's been so little transparency from the police department as to what the officer, Darren Wilson, actually did that day. I mean, how he encountered Mike Brown and whether or not he was beaten up first or whether Michael Brown had his hands up or not. There's so much of that out there that I can't possibly see nobody at least taking him off the street, and until this is settled, just trying to get to the bottom of it. But then the answer to your question, there have been so many conflicting stories, and the transparency was lacking from the beginning because it still bothers me. It took 2 days of that city basically exploding before anybody even suggested that the officer might have had a valid reason to shoot Mike Brown. I don't see why, if the cops really thought that Brown was a criminal suspect and that he had attacked an officer, why didn't any of that come out in those first 2 days?
Any thoughts on that, Chris?
To Eugene's point, I think we're still getting more of the story, and it's hard to disagree with that point that, you know, in an officer-involved shooting, I would hope that that's pretty much standard practice, that an officer is taken off the street and, you know, put on desk duty or whatever it is that happens. And I think that the police department there does not exactly deserve, you know, very high marks for how it handled things, particularly initially. I don't think it helped. I think they put out the video that supposedly showed, Mr. Brown taking some cigars or something like that, which was, you know, the timing was bad. You know, I don't know what their motives were, but they weren't, you know, they didn't handle things very well. So I think that in the absence of, you know, clear, you know, facts and a clear timeline and all these differing stories out there, that is just going to fan the flames, get people confused and cause them to take up arms and take sides. And I think that's what happened here.
Yeah. So what's your takeaway from this so far, Eugene Kane? What, if any, lessons have we learned from what's happened in Ferguson?
Well, I know as an African-American of a certain age, I was too young when the 60s riots to understand what was going on when there were cities where black people just sort of rose up after the assassination of Martin Luther King, and even in Milwaukee back in the 60s when there was a riot around also reports of police abuse of a black suspect. I was too young for that. I do remember the L.A. riots, which was scary, and that was the first time I got a sense of just how, you know, frightening it is when things get out of control like that. So then when now, almost 20 years later, we have this, it makes you see that there is something about these urban riots that always has a common denominator. That's that it's usually about police activity. It's usually the case of the police being accused of abusing and a lot of times killing an unarmed black suspect. And I just don't think that's a coincidence. And until we learn that lesson, doing some proactive things in these communities where a lot of black people are just basically very suspicious and even afraid of the police, who are basically the ones who are patrolling their neighborhoods. We've got to get a handle on police-community relations, but what Ferguson shows is that clearly we haven't done that yet. And that's always scary because there are so many circumstances, similar circumstances existing in so many cities, including Milwaukee. We've had a couple high-profile cases of black suspects dying in police custody here or being shot and people think it's a wrongful shooting. It's almost like we're constantly dodging these bullets. Either one of those cases in Milwaukee could have turned into a full-blown riot. Nobody wants to see that, but you just can't keep dancing on the edge of the fire like that.
Yeah. Any lessons or takeaways for you, Chris?
Not at this time. And Joy, you and I were talking about this off air before things started up. I feel a little uncomfortable, you know, commenting on this because I don't think we have all the information yet to make a definitive statement about, you know, the larger picture, what this is and what this represents. I mean, you know, ultimately, I wasn't there, of course. Joy wasn't there. Your listeners weren't there. Eugene weren't there. We just don't know. So for me, it's kind of like let's wait until we see all the facts come out. I mean, we've heard all the differing stories. There's a lot of conflicting accounts, and typically, we all know from past experience in stories like this, oftentimes the truth is somewhere in between, and we kind of have to wait for that to sort of fan itself out. The investigations have to run their course, and we have to see what comes of them. And you know, I certainly have no doubt that if a crime was committed here, people are going to be charged and going to be tried for it. But we just have to wait. We're not there yet.
1-800. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Eugene.
No, Joy, excuse me. I think what I've noticed is that there seems to be almost a learned behavior by both police and people in the community, and even to a degree the looters who showed up. People who have never been involved in a riot, they seem to assume certain behavior because I guess a lot of people have seen riots on TV, whether it's L.A. or the grainy black and white from the 60s. And there's almost a sense that once that kind of lawlessness starts, people just kind of assume roles. And even the cops seem to take a real aggressive stance because maybe that's the only real training they have, because that's based on the way they've seen police departments react in the past. So that was interesting to me. Another interesting thing was this was the first time I actually heard of people trying to prevent looting by, you know, standing in front of stores and turning people away from the looting because they realized that it would look bad on TV. And that was kind of encouraging. But those are just kind of things I noticed that, well, it's almost like there's learned behavior about how to act when there's a riot.
We are talking with Eugene Kane and Chris Lotto during this edition of our Week in Review, talking about the issues raised by the events in Ferguson, Missouri right now. We'll take some of your reactions and questions about it. Still going to talk a little bit about concerns over militarization of our police departments based on Ferguson, and talk some about how President Obama is handling this particular situation. Plus, how's President Obama handling the latest horror from ISIS? We'll talk about the murder of an American journalist by ISIS and what that means for U.S. Military strikes in Iraq. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. A little later in the program, we'll get to other top national and state political stories. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking today with Chris Lotto, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin, GOP campaign consultant, and Eugene Kane, a columnist and blogger from Milwaukee. You can read his work on Sundays in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we welcome your thoughts, your questions, the issues from the news this week that you would like to discuss. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Will in Windsor joins us first. Hi, Will.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. What's happening in Ferguson is a culmination of anger built up over the years that was created by structural and institutional racism that affects the life of every person of color in this country. And it's not just one incident that caused this. Yeah. Police brutality is part of it, but it's a much larger picture than that have not been discussed in this country as of yet.
Yeah, is that part of the reason for the anger? It was pent up because of the institutionalized racism. Eugene, your thoughts on that?
Well, I've heard a lot of my African-American friends have that exact opinion, and I agree to a large part to what he's saying, although it's hard to explain to people what exactly you're saying if they're not black and don't really, or, well, I can't say that. Some white people do understand it, but my attitude is that, yes, there are problems in this country that have never been addressed with, never been put on the table. It makes people too uncomfortable to talk about it. This is a 70% black community, Ferguson, that has almost no black elected officials. Now, you can blame, and the police department has very few black officers, I think maybe only one or two. So you can explain that away any way you want, but I think black people look at that and just understand that's not a coincidence. That happens for a reason.
Yeah, well, Chris, we apparently that's a problem, isn't it? If a community like Ferguson doesn't have enough African Americans on, it doesn't represent the community on the police department or in elected offices.
Well, if something good does come out of it, then perhaps it is, and you know that a terrible incident has to prompt this kind of dialogue. Then you know it's unfortunate, but maybe that is one of the good things that comes out of what happened in Ferguson, is that that does open the dialogue in that community, and other communities like it throughout the U.S. Ferguson is not isolated in that regard.
Let's go to our next caller, and it's Marie in Waukesha. Hello, Marie.
Well, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. The question that I have is, why did violence beget violence? The police officer, for some reason, shot this young man, and now the community has reacted to it by looting not the police officer's home, but each other. I don't understand it. I live in a rural community. I've never lived in a big city, so I don't believe it's something that would happen in my community if someone was accidentally shot. And then the other question is...
And Marie, what if you believed it wasn't an accidental shooting? It was an unjust, racist shooting.
Even if it was, I don't know that the response should be more violence.
Yeah, what about Eugene?
Well, the violence in the beginning was in response to the heavy police presence. The looting, again, my theory is that a lot of people just, they've never really been in a riot, but they've seen pictures of riots, and they see that as an opportunity. And I think it's a small segment. Everybody that I've talked to who reported on this said it wasn't everybody looting the stores, but there are always opportunists. And again, I was encouraged by there was a group of The Washington Post reported on a group of young black men who stood guard on stores because they realized it was getting out of hand, and if everybody looted, I mean, it would make the town look bad. And nobody can ignore also, if you're talking about a community that is poor and underserved, I mean, it's bad to steal and it's bad to loot, but when people see an opportunity to get something free, I mean, it speaks to their character, but it is part of the dynamic that, I mean, it's lawlessness. All of a sudden, there's nobody around to guard these stores. It happens in a lot of moments of civil unrest. I don't condone it, and I will, I'll denounce it, but I understand that when things break down, looting is one residual effect of it.
Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a very slippery slope that we get into because we're speculating on, what happened in Ferguson to set all this off, and smarter people than me, sociologists and stuff can talk about the quote unquote mob mentality that goes into situations like that and how it kind of feeds that kind of behavior. I do think Eugene is onto something that, individuals are responsible for their own actions, and those who decide to look at, this tragic matter, and we're still waiting to hear more about what actually happened, but, undeniably tragic, the idea that this gives people an excuse to take to, take to the streets and clean out stores and get theirs is unfortunate and sad. And, those individuals should obviously be held into account as well.
Eugene mentioned the heavy police presence, and others noted the military grade equipment and gear that was rolled out in Ferguson. And it has a number of people wondering if local police forces need to be demilitarized, including members of Missouri's congressional delegation. Records show the Pentagon has given police agencies in Wisconsin more than $28 million in surplus military gear in the past decade, including assault rifles, grenade launchers, mine resistant trucks. Would you say that our police are too militarized, Chris?
I mean, not Not necessarily. I mean, I think we're taking this one incident and perhaps trying to put it in the context of police agencies throughout the country. I saw that President Obama commented on it this week and essentially punted on the issue, saying that, you know, perhaps a study is in order and that people would get behind a study, which to me does not suggest any sort of blanket condemnation of this from the White House. This is a program that's been in place, this military surplus sharing, since the 1990s, I believe, ramped up after 9/11. So, you know, there will be a study. I get the sense that the president doesn't necessarily think that this is cause to reverse the program. And I don't think, I mean, certainly in Wisconsin, I don't know that we have, you know, a major issue with militarization of our police forces. But again, it gets more dialogue going. People are going to talk about it and look at the issue a little more closely. But I don't get the sense that there is going to be some sort of massive swing to stop this program.
Yeah. Does this need to be studied more, Eugene?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things and important things to come out of this from a journalistic viewpoint is the news that we've got all these police departments, some of them in very small suburban communities, that have essentially war machines at their disposal. And I think it's very reasonable for people to wonder, why would some suburban township or some place where that doesn't even have that much crime per capita each year, what do they need an armored tank for? What do they need flamethrowers and tear gas for? I mean, black people sometimes get paranoid and think, well, they're stocking, and I've heard this, they're stocking all that up because they're afraid of the day when black people do riot. And that's a very cynical way of looking at it. But I think as a journalist, I was very surprised to find out that the reason a town like Ferguson or that county is able to pull in all that big artillery is because apparently they've been preparing for it for years. And it makes me wonder, what exactly were they preparing for? What do you need, like I say, basically a tank for if you're just policing, you know, a small suburban community? So I think that study, sure, we need to study that and understand that, you know, we complain so much about the money we spend on things. I can't imagine these small communities need to be spending that much money to buy this stuff.
Yeah, I was gonna add as well that if you look at it from a fiscal perspective, I think that's a fair question to ask. Is this money really being wasted on communities that don't need this type of equipment? And I think that is a fair question to ask, and perhaps there is a way for us to you know, cut back some of that spending.
Well, President Obama spoke out a second time this past week on what was going on in Ferguson. And some observers, the Associated Press and Politico, say that he's kind of struggling to determine what role he should play, if any, as the nation's first black president in defusing the crisis. And some say that he wasn't necessarily as personal talking out on this situation in Ferguson as he was during the Trayvon Martin case. A CBS News New York Times poll shows 41% of Americans are satisfied with how President Obama is responding to the events in Ferguson. 34% are dissatisfied. Eugene, what do you think of Obama's handling of the situation?
Well, I take the general viewpoint that people expect too much of Obama as the first African-American president, even other African-Americans. And I have even written and on social networks communicated that essentially he's a politician and approaches things like a politician. He took such a beating off Trayvon Martin in terms of criticizing the way he kind of personally empathized with that victim that it's not surprising to me that he's decided not to go in as full bore as he did. I think the most significant thing that he did in Ferguson was send the top law enforcement guy in the nation to Ferguson. So you can't really fault him or say that he's ignoring the situation. They've gotten so used to hearing these flowery and powerful speeches from Obama, people seem to think that all he has to do is show up and make that kind of speech and everything will be all right. And that's never been the case. So I just think there's too many expectations on him. I think he's done pretty much as he could do in terms of addressing Ferguson, and I don't have any problems with the way he's been acting.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna switch gears and ask you, Chris, to think about how do you rate President Obama's response, reaction, handling of the whole ISIS crisis in the news this week? Horrible murder of an American journalist, a Marquette grad. He was beheaded in retaliation for U.S. Military strikes in Iraq. Your thoughts on this situation?
Yeah, horrible. I mean, stomach turning. The execution, awful. And I know we're going to get more into the issue of ISIS and what America does about it. I think, in general, the president is starting to move in the direction, I think, of doing the right thing. And I think the pressure is increasing on him to articulate a policy that people can get behind. And, we can go more into the policy. I was going to tie this into Ferguson. I know mm-hmm. he took some heat this week. Between Ferguson, the situation with ISIS, he's out playing golf with Alonzo Mourning. And we all remember from the days of George W. Bush when he took heat for being out on the golf course. There is a perception problem that I wonder sometimes if he's really aware or perhaps doesn't care about what that perception is, that he's maybe not as fully engaged as he ought to be. Now, to be fair, I don't know what to expect from him in the case of certainly of Ferguson. I think on ISIS, I think we have a pretty clear, mission that he's going to have to deal with here. But, I do think that, again, kind of going back to Ferguson for one more minute, that, I don't want to look at President Obama through the prism of he's the first black president or a black man who's president. I just want to look at his actions as president, because I think that's more consistent. And also, again, in Ferguson, we don't know with the core incident itself. Was it truly racially motivated? Was there a civil rights violation with the white officer shooting that black suspect? I think, we still have to wait for more information before we can determine that. But I think that, when it comes to ISIS, he had a fairly strong statement this week, and now he needs to back it up with action, because there has been a pretty good case made that perhaps he let ISIS get too much of a foothold and make gains in the Middle East for too long before starting to take action, because now we really do need to take action.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that in just a moment, but a quick react, Eugene, to the criticism that President Obama did receive making a statement about ISIS and the beheading of Marquette graduate James Foley, and then reportedly going out golfing.
Well, I think certainly it was terrible optics in terms of the way people would react to it. But I've come to realize, I think at this point, President Obama doesn't really care about that part of his critics who will sort of find fault with anything he does. I was surprised to find out, less than an hour after the speech against the tough speech, talking about there's no place for ISIS in the 21st century and communicating to Americans that this was an urgent problem, that he just continued his vacation. But I can't, I understand also that presidents in the past have taken their vacations and dealt with emergencies during their vacation and then went back to their vacation. So it didn't look good. I'll admit that as someone, who usually likes most things Obama does. It didn't look good, but I think he's at the point, maybe that stuff doesn't really concern him as much anymore.
Yeah. Well, Senator Ron Johnson said this week, and this was before the murder, that ISIS must be eradicated or else they will eventually send terrorists to the U.S., that they're going to end up in the U.S. How concerned are you about ISIS operating in America, Chris?
I saw that Rick Perry raised that issue this week and took some heat for it, saying that he was overreacting. I don't know that he is, and I don't know that anybody can say that they know with certainty that kind of attitude is an overreaction right now. Certainly some of the things that we're hearing, some of the rhetoric from Senator Johnson is alarming. He's not the only one saying it either. I mean, they clearly in Congress, they are very alarmed by what is going on there and realize that action has to be taken. Is the threat, in America an imminent one? I mean, I think it would be a mistake for us to wait to find out.
Mm-hmm. Eugene, your thoughts on that?
I think after 2001, people realize that there are people all over the globe certain groups that are looking to, you know, come here and do damage, and they don't care how many people they kill or how much damage they do. And ISIS is, from what I've heard, I'm not an expert on ISIS. I'm one of the Americans who really just recently started hearing about ISIS, because I'm sure the government has known about them for a long time. So they strike me as, you know, barbarians, evil people, but it's not, at least the way I see it, one sovereign nation or country that we could target and then go bomb and destroy. So it just gets very complicated to say what the response is. I'm always cynical when people like Perry and Ron Johnson start beating these drums, because it makes you think, well, what are they suggesting? We should go attack someone? We should, you know, drop a bomb on someone? And part of me thinks that it's always connected to their battle against or their attempts to sort of demean Obama. I just always see a political angle to that that just is very, it's very unlikable to me. So
yeah, well,
that's what I think. ISIS is very terrible and they need to be dealt with. But until you really figure out what the proper response would be, it makes no good to kind of tell Americans, well, we need to, they're coming after us and we need to stop them. Because what does that mean?
Yeah, so what do Republicans want Obama to do something differently than he's doing, Chris?
Well, the airstrikes have increased in recent days and weeks under President Obama, and I think that there's something of a consensus forming that needs to intensify, that the airstrikes need to be increased and sustained, and that there are targets that we can go after. Again, going back to Rick Perry, I think speaking in front of the Heritage Foundation this week, he raised the possibility of ground troops. Americans are by and large war weary, and the idea that we would go back to the Middle East, I'm sure, is something that people are probably going to be against just at first blush if they hear something like that. And I don't think most people are saying at this point, certainly not most Republicans, that needs to happen right now. But certainly a campaign of airstrikes. That, you know, President Obama, to the degree that he can, you know, articulate to the American people that he's got this under control. But I think the administration sees a need there, and that's evidenced by the fact that those airstrikes have increased recently.
So Senator Ron Johnson on ISIS this afternoon after 3 on Central Time, if you want to talk more about that. Moving on, Congressman Paul Ryan released his new book, The Way Forward, Renewing the American Idea, this week. He talked about it in Milwaukee yesterday. He said that the book pushes full-spectrum conservatism through a mix of step-by-step policy proposals. So, Chris Lotto, what do you think of Paul Ryan's advice to the GOP?
I'm a big Paul Ryan admirer. I think he's one of the sharpest minds in Congress, and certainly would love to see him make a go of presidential run in 2016, although I think the jury's still out on whether he's going to actually do that. You know, it's hard to argue with what he's saying. I think it's a message that both sides could take to heart, the idea that you want to put forth substance. I think, you know, the fact of the matter is, and this has just gotten worse over time, in the heat of a campaign cycle, which seems to be a perpetual cycle now, you know, the issues kind of fall by the wayside, and it starts to become about, you know, who has the better soundbite, who has the sharper TV ad or the stronger, you know, jab. And there's plenty of blame to go around. You can blame the media. You can blame the campaign spinmeisters. You can blame the rise of social media for cheapening political discourse. You can blame the voters for not demanding more of their candidates. I mean, there's enough of that to go around. You know, but right now this is the way it is. I mean, this is the modern form of campaigning. And, you know, politics has become really kind of a nonstop food fight in a sense. And I think people like Paul Ryan do a real service by trying to rise above that. He is one of those guys who walks it like he talks it. There are certainly people who can't stand his stance on issues. I understand that. They're, you know, Democrats and whatnot, but I don't think you can argue that Paul Ryan is a serious and substantive member of Congress, and I think that he's on the right track by calling for fellow Republicans to follow his lead.
Does Paul Ryan know the way forward, Eugene Cain?
Well, I'm glad at least this is a time where me and Chris can actually disagree on something, because I'm not a fan of Paul Ryan. I don't think he has much substance. I just still remember his talk, his words and his philosophies expressed during his run with Romney. And now I understand in his book, he's sort of backtracking on his whole makers and takers idea that Americans are either makers or takers, that 47% nonsense that basically torpedoed Romney's chances. And I think it's just weird that now all of a sudden he's acting, Paul Ryan is acting as though, oh, I rethought that, and I understand that, but that sounded like I was calling Americans who are out of work or who are struggling deadbeats. I mean, you should have realized that back then. I mean, I'm just very skeptical of somebody like Ryan, who has gotten a lot of benefits and now has made a career out of trying to deny those benefits to other Americans. And it just doesn't strike me as anything more than a guy trying to put on a new suit and possibly trying to go for another run for national office. But we here in Wisconsin have seen enough of his warts to know that Paul Ryan is no great towering statesman. The stuff he's talking about is still kind of warmed over conservative thought from the last, you know, I don't want to put a time limit on it, I'd say even the last decade or so. And I think when he thinks, if he thought he could win with saying that 47% was still as strong as it was in the last election, and he could talk bad about those people, he would start doing that again. Now he's just kind of throwing that stuff at the wall, trying to paint a new Republican Party that is, there's no real evidence that anybody is really looking to bring that about. So, no, I don't see Paul Ryan as leading us out of anything.
All right. Well, we have to take a quick break. And, by the way, Congressman Ryan is going to be on this program on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday at 7:30. So we'll talk more about the way forward then. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Eugene Kane and Chris Lotto during this edition of our Week in Review, talking about the top international, national, and state political stories. We still haven't hit the state of Wisconsin, and we'll talk more politics, especially state of Wisconsin politics, coming up after this. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine with Chris Lotto and Eugene Kane this week, talking about the top stories in politics. This is the time when we usually have our Week in Review quiz. Something different this week. We are going to ask our Week in Review quiz question at the end of this hour, maybe about 5 minutes to the hour. And you are going to be asked to call in and guess or answer, I hope, on air. So wait for the Week in Review quiz question coming up at the end of the hour. And we'll talk with our guests a little bit about the quiz question, too. It's going to be on the ice challenge, ALS ice bucket challenge. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. Well, let's talk about still some more politics to wrap up here. National Republican politics this week. Texas Governor Rick Perry formally pleaded not guilty to criminal charges that he abused his office when he vetoed state funding for public corruption prosecutors. Perry has been defiant since he was indicted last week. Chris Lotto, what's going on here? Where's this all going?
I don't. Does anybody on the left or the right really take this indictment seriously? It is so clearly politically motivated in nature. You know, with local Texas politics and Democrats sharpening their knives trying to take out Rick Perry. Look at it this way. When you have the New York Times editorial board on your side, as Rick Perry does in this case, you're probably, pretty safe. I mean, they're clearly no fan of Rick Perry, but even they said that this indictment was, an overzealous act. Governor Perry was essentially acting well within his powers in enacting the veto. I think, this could boomerang in a sense. Rick Perry's been thinking about running for president again. He melted down in 2012 pretty quickly and didn't dazzle a whole lot of folks. I don't know before this incident that a lot of people had Rick Perry very high on their radar. I think the memories of 2012 are still fresh in their minds, and perhaps we're underestimating him. And I feel like this is the kind of thing that could help him in conservative circles. Could help his narrative, because now he's the Republican who stood tall against those rabid Democrats who will stop at nothing to take out a Republican. That's the part of the story that he can tell. So, you know, it could end up helping him a little bit. Now, ultimately, he's going to stand and or fall on things other than this, but certainly in the short term, I think it gives him a boost.
Any thoughts on Rick Perry, Eugene?
Well, I've read the interesting take that both Democrats and Republicans seem to think there's something bogus going on. But I look at it as though whenever you see indictment behind the name of anybody in politics, that's pretty serious. I mean, he showed up in court and he had to plead not guilty. So, I mean, I understand there's a cesspool of politics in Texas, but that's for all the parties there. So he's gotten himself into something that it doesn't matter if the New York Times editorial board or anybody speaks out against it. This is going to be decided in court there. So I don't have enough information to say right off that, oh, it's bogus, these charges are bogus, or that there might be some smoke and fire here. But I do think, you know, it is interesting that a lot of people in the consensus is that, oh, this was just a political thing. But there's a lot of political prosecutions, and sometimes people get sent to jail for it.
Moving on to another topic, the liberal group Greater Wisconsin Committee bought $737,000 worth of ads in a campaign against Governor Walker this week. The first ad hammers Walker's job creation efforts and how Wisconsin has lagged behind neighboring states. It also contends that Walker doled out state money to help his campaign supporters. Walker then cited jobs data that he previously had dismissed as less than reliable to argue that the state's economy is rebounding. Eugene, what do you think this huge ad buy tells us about this issue and this race?
Well, I think people see Walker as vulnerable. I think they see it as basically a dead heat between him and Burke, and money in politics is, you know, mother's milk, and even though it doesn't always mean that you can turn the results of an election, I certainly think if you're a liberal group, you got that money to pay in an election. The governor's race in Wisconsin is certainly an important race for you. So there's been a lot of money spent in all these elections. So it didn't really surprise me that much that you're spending money to defeat Walker. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't see anything necessarily wrong with it as long as you're doing it legally.
Chris Lotta?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, today it benefits Mary Burke. Tomorrow it's going to benefit Scott Walker. I mean, the money's coming in. It's going to benefit both sides. And the only question is, at the end of the day, how many millions are going to end up being spent on this race? I'm sure the record, it will probably set a record or come very close. And we're talking tens of millions of dollars here. I think that, here's the bottom line. Wisconsin's economy is recovering. That is not in dispute. The question becomes, is it recovering at a pace that is enough to satisfy the voters of Wisconsin? Mary Burke is being put kind of in an awkward position here because she's kind of has to root for Wisconsin to be failing, because that's really her only path to victory. They obviously see Scott Walker as vulnerable on the jobs issue again, in spite of the fact that we are moving in the right direction and we are recovering. So her only path to victory is to say, well, you know, Wisconsin's failing. We're not getting the job done. And I think that's a negative message. And I think that we've seen time and time again in statewide races in Wisconsin that the negative stuff doesn't really work and that it's going to backfire. And I think that this is not a good position for her to be in, because I don't think it's going to pay off.
Yeah, we still have a couple of issues to hit on before the end of the hour. Very briefly, a Legislative Fiscal Bureau report out this week says that Medicaid expansion, the accepting of federal money, would have saved Wisconsin $206 million. Chris Lotta, was it a mistake for Governor Walker to reject that money?
Governor Walker extended coverage to adults at or below the poverty level. That's something Wisconsin's doing now for the first time ever. Wisconsin didn't have a coverage gap. We have one of the lowest rates of uninsured in the nation, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. $1.2 billion put toward Medicaid in the last session. That was the biggest single agency funding increase. There's no guarantee that money's going to be there. The payments are going to start ramping down in 2016. Governor Walker did the right thing.
Right thing or wrong thing, Eugene?
Well, it was the wrong thing because he's taken money away from the state. And if the Legislative Fiscal Bureau has prepared this and says it's a fact, I don't see how, well, I see how people can dispute it because people dispute everything. But clearly, I think I heard this in the beginning of Walker's term, that if he rejected that money, it would cost us. And now it seems that people have went through the numbers and have figured out that at least that claim is true. So he can't run away from that.
We'll have State Senator Jennifer Schilling, who requested this report from the Fiscal Bureau on our state capital report on Monday after 7, and Republican State Representative Dave Knutson, who is going to be giving us a different perspective after Dean Knutson, I'm sorry, after 7:30. All right, let's see. Is there going to be a recount in the 6th Congressional District, Chris?
A sense of deja vu here, because Senator Liebum went through a recount back in 2002, and I actually was among those who helped work on that recount on his behalf. It was a close race, but I think that recent past history shows that at this margin, it might not be enough to turn things around in favor of Senator Liebum. He's certainly within his rights to ask for it, and it's close enough that I think it would be understandable if he did. But it is probably unlikely at this stage of the game to think that it would reverse the results and that Glenn Grothman would not be the GOP candidate.
Well, it's time now for me to do the Week in Review quiz question. Here it is. The viral ice bucket challenge to raise money and awareness for ALS research hit the presidential level this week. Former President George W. Bush was challenged by a number of people, but he said it was not presidential to be splashed with ice water and that he was just going to write a check. But then moments later on the video, former First Lady Laura Bush gave him a dunking with some ice water. Who did George W. Bush call upon to step up to the plate next? Who did he challenge to take the ice bucket challenge? That's the question. Do you know the answer? 1-800-642-1234. Call us right now, and if you are the first caller with a correct answer that we're going to ask you to give on air, you will win a valuable prize. It's really not a valuable prize. You'll get some sort of a pen or some sort of swag from Wisconsin Public Radio. So call us and let us know, who did George W. Bush challenge to the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge? And as we wait for that winner, we hope to call in. Let me just get some quick thoughts from you, Eugene Kane, on what do you think of this Ice Bucket Challenge?
I know it's a good cause, but my nature is to always become kind of annoyed when things get saturated on social media. And I actually raised a question with someone. What happened to days when people made anonymous donations to charity? Some people think it's a combination of narcissism and giving to charity, but I don't want to be that hard on them. But
okay.
That's generally my takeaway from it. It's just getting to be kind of jumping the shark right now.
Yeah, what do you think, Chris?
Wouldn't social media collapse without a good, healthy dose of narcissism? Isn't that kind of what it's all about? There is that thing. I guess it's good to see that social media is being used for something positive. I guess they've raised something like $23 million in the last 3 weeks. It was an 1,100% increase. So it is helping a good cause, but yeah, there's a little bit of a look at me, Ma kind of component to it.
All right, we gotta see if we have a winner here. Let's go to Jeanette in Milwaukee. Do you know who did President George W. Bush challenge?
Clinton.
Well, we have our winner. So stay on the line. We'll get your contact information, and Justin Williams will send you your valuable prize. Let's take a listen. This is who did President George W. Bush call upon to do the ice bucket challenge? Let's hear it from W. himself.
Now it's my privilege to challenge my friend Bill Clinton to the ALS challenge. Yesterday was Bill's birthday, and my gift to Bill is a bucket of cold water.
Ha, ha, ha. President Clinton has yet to respond. And I guess we'll have to leave it there. All right. Everybody, have a good weekend. I hope you join us on Monday for more talk about issues that matter to you. And Chris Lotto and Eugene Kane, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network.